today we are looking at something, as I say, which is highly topical. The subject is the United Kingdom-China relationship. Should Britain and China, in inverted commas, stick together? That seems to be the big question that is being asked in the papers and elsewhere. And so I'd be very interested to hear the views of my panel, but also to hear the views of this audience. We have a very interesting panel today. On my right, Sir Martin Davidson, who is a former chief executive of the British Council. He's a Mandarin speaker, I think that's right. And he previously worked for several years in both Beijing and Hong Kong. He chairs the Great Britain China Centre's board of directors. And he has a full commitment to international relations, which has been a constant feature of his career. I've got a lot else on him here, but I think that's probably enough for the moment to let you know he has a very solid and deep interest and knowledge of the working of China in the international community. On my far left, Richard Graham, who's the MP for Gloucester. He is the Prime Minister's Trade Envoy to Indonesia and the ASEAN Economic Community. And he previously was PPS to Lord Howe, who is a supporter, as you know, of this group and has spoken here on many occasions. And he's here today because he chairs the All-Party Parliamentary Group on China, and I thought it was important for us to hear the parliamentary view of what is happening at the moment. And then finally, on my near left, Professor Michelle Hawkes, who is the Professor of Chinese at SOAS, the University of London, and finally Director of SOAS China Institute. He studied Chinese language and literature at Leiden University in the Netherlands and at Liaoning and Peking Universities in China. And he's published widely on modern Chinese literary and cultural communities. So again, we have another view which I'm looking forward to hearing from you today. I understand he was on television yesterday outside Buckingham Palace commentating on the tour, so we might even get a rather more immediate view of it. Without more ado, I'm going to ask our first speaker, Sir Martin Davidson, if he'd speak to us for about 10 minutes. When the three of them have spoken, we'll have about half an hour for you to ask questions or to make comments. Thank you very much.
Michael, thank you very much indeed. When he was in Shanghai earlier this month, the Chancellor said the global economy was like a damaged aeroplane flying on one engine, and that was the Chinese engine. And they went on to say that the world still needs Chinese help. I think that's probably broadly true. But actually what's also true is that China also needs the world's help. Lots of phrases that are going around at the moment. The famous phrase around a soft landing, about the middle income trap, about whether or not the Chinese economy can continue to sustain itself. Lo Jiwei, the Chinese finance minister in May, got himself into a little bit of hot water by saying that he felt it was only 50-50 whether or not China would avoid the middle income trap. And last month when Liu Yandong, the Chinese vice premier, was here on the people-to-people dialogue, it was an extremely interesting presentation at that point about the Chinese economy from a very leading Chinese economist who, though not using exactly the same phrase, pretty well echoed that sense of, well, it's a 50-50 chance for China to avoid the middle income trap, to really move itself into the upper echelons of the world economy. Not as the largest economy of the world, which almost certainly will become, but that deep transformation of its economy. And there are a number of factors which go into that. One of the things that, again, George Osborne said is that China is trying to do the extraordinarily difficult thing of moving from an economy which is driven by investment to an economy which is driven by consumption. And in order to do that, China has to make significant and substantial reforms. And the economist I was talking about, the key point he wanted to make was that reform is an absolute requisite. It isn't an option. It isn't something that Chinese leadership can actually pick and choose whether or not they're going to continue. It is an absolute requisite if they are going to be able to make the sort of transition that they're talking about. And what sort of aspects of that reform were they talking about? Some quite interesting ones. First of all, investment. Investment in the future, he said, has to be driven by economic return, not by political advantage. There has to be real credit availability within the broader market. China has to move towards a proper fiscal management environment. it's no longer good enough to draw your funds from state-owned enterprises which are protected politically. But equally, if you're going to draw your public funding through taxation, then you actually have to have a taxation system which is capable of being managed. Major liberalisation of the labour market, not least the transformation of the hukou, the permit to live in the big cities, but much more fundamental transformation of the labour market. And one of the key points he also made was liberalisation of the financial markets. A financial market which is manipulated by government is not a financial market which is capable of meeting the investment requirements of business. And then two final things he mentioned. One was open banking and the extent to which the Chinese banks are so deeply indebted that there is a significant issue for them there. And the last one, ownership of land and holding of land and the impact that that has on the way in which transformation, particularly in the rural area, will take place in the future. And those are really pretty substantial and heavy set of agendas which China has to deal with. And one of the things that China is remarkably good at, in my view, in my experience, is looking around the world to find help and examples from elsewhere. And I think there is a great deal of evidence to demonstrate that they have, for really most of the past 30 years, and will continue to look to this country, to the UK, as one of the key places as a partner in making some of that transformation. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that China is simply going to pick up systems that are available or adopted in this country and adopt them wholesale into China. It's going to do its own thing in its own way. I was last week in China, and this is my second visit in the last 3 or 4 months, and two constants which came through in routine conversations with people. First of all was the UK's accession to the AIIB, the Asian Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank. And that sense that UK has been a partner, a very important partner, in helping China meet its own aspirations as becoming a leading figure in the world. The second slightly curious conversation piece was that extraordinary BBC programme on the Chinese schools. I don't know how many of you actually saw it, of Chinese school teachers coming to teach in a British school and finding it difficult. What was for me fascinating about the response from China was not, isn't it dreadful how awful your children are, is it really a human right to have a kettle, or whatever the other piece of cleverly edited film was shown, but actually, what does this mean about our own education system? What does it mean about the way in which we teach our children? If we're going to have a really effective economy, a first world economy, which is our aim, then we need to have a creative economy. And where is that going to come from? How are we going to build it? What does it mean in terms of how we change our schools? And a very minor example of some of that was during Liu Yandong's visit last month, the agreement that the UK would support the development of sport in school, football in school. Truth of the matter is, there is no sport in Chinese school except in specialist schools, which are all about training people for the Olympics or the World Cup or whatever it might be. But actually, a widening of that school curriculum, which gives people the opportunity to really build different skills which are going to be useful outside purely academic environment, are extraordinarily shallow at the moment. Just one example of the way in which China is changing. Core, I would argue, to most of those changes which China wants is the issue of the rule of law. This is something which I'm sure you're aware came through very, very strongly in the fourth plenum in October with the party emphasising reform and the rule of law. Is something which the President mentioned both at the Buckingham Palace speech last night, but also to his speech to the Joint Houses of Parliament in the afternoon. The decision to move towards a rule of law is absolutely central. And the answers to that question of why, I think, are equally obvious. If you're an international investor coming to invest in China, you want certainty around contract law. You want certainty around ownership. You want certainty around legal access. You want certainty that the legal decision made in one place will actually be the same as the legal decision made elsewhere. You want it to be applicable across the country, not applicable solely in the place where you're actually doing business. And if that is the requirement for foreign companies, how much more so is it the requirement for Chinese companies? And again, some of the discussions I was having last week, the Chinese companies are absolutely desperate to have a sound investment environment, legal investment environment, through which they can actually start making investment further inland. And that is absolutely the heart also of the next stage of Chinese transformation. It has to build a stronger economy further inland, build the opportunity to spread wealth more widely. And that's one of the reasons why, for my organisation, the Great Britain China Centre, the work that we're now doing around judicial dialogue, training of judges, the role of media and publicity for judicial activities, the creation of our Common Law Centre in People's University in Beijing. These are all critical elements of building that sense of rule of law. Does rule of law in China mean exactly the same things it means here in this country? At the moment, almost certainly not. But getting some of it right, it seems to me, is an awful lot better than getting all of it wrong. And that is just one example of some of the sets of changes. We talk all the time about economic and commercial collaboration. But actually what China is looking for is a much more widely based set of collaborations. It's wanting youth exchanges, not having people going on gap years in each other's countries, but long-term opportunity for attachments, work attachments, internships for young people in both countries to work in each side. They're looking for engagement in sport, they're looking for engagement in creativity, they're looking for engagement in an extraordinary range of activity. So should China and Britain stick together? Yes. But it is not simply us being there, as I think an American on the Today programme said, like a panting puppy. It's about a relationship which is of equal value, if not more value to China, as it is to ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. I'm going to ask Richard Graham to speak to us as well. Not to do it from the rostrum, it's easier for people to hear. Thanks.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, lovely to be with you at this Global Strategy Forum. One of the reasons I took slightly longer to get here than usual was, of course, fighting my way through the opposing lobbying groups of the Chinese opposite 10 Downing Street. Actually, the question of should the UK and China stick together is really how do all the different parts and views of China stick together would be a different sort of question. It seems to me the question that Michael Lothian has given us today is all about marriage. It's a marriage question, isn't it? And what is the balance of the pros and cons always comes into this, although not in my direct experience, but in experience of watching my sisters and brother go through these things, it seems to me to all come down to emotion and above all trust. And trust is really one of the key questions, I think, in the relationship between the UK and China. It's the key question mark in a strategic partnership where the two partners start off with very different values. To what extent can we trust each other? So I want to try and run through a few thoughts on this and how the relationship has changed over the 35 years since I first went to China. But just to start on an anecdote, in terms of sticking together, I think probably the Chinese security proposal yesterday to have security guards on the top of the royal carriages as they went down the Mall was probably a sticking together too far for the occupants of Buckingham Palace. So there are limits to sticking together. The relationship, then, it has changed massively. It's changed since Martin was representing British Council in the south of China and I was British Trade Commissioner there 25 years ago. It's changed since the handover of Hong Kong 18 years ago, and it's changed again since the Great Recession in the West of 2007-10. And when I accompanied the Prime Minister 2 years ago to China, and we hosted a lunch in the Shanghai Exhibition Centre, I was very struck by the range and depth of the relationship today. Outside the Exhibition Centre, there was a guard of honour from every car being made in Britain at the moment that's exported to China. In rough terms of size. There was a Mini, a black taxi, an Aston Martin, a Jaguar, a McLaren, a Land Rover and a Range Rover. Remember that we sell more Jaguars in China than we do in the UK now. That certainly would not have been the case. None of those vehicles would have been there and being sold in China only 10 years ago. Inside we had Adele playing, who is a great hit in China. We had Sherlock and Downton Abbey playing on the screen, also great hits. I think about 200 million people in China have watched Downton, so it was very nice that about 50 of them got the chance to live Downton Abbey last night in Buckingham Palace. We had the Premier League trophy there. Of course, Manchester United has many more followers in China than in the UK. The food and the English wine, note the English wine, was provided by Intercontinental Hotels, a great British company. And last but by no means least, Joey the Warhorse starred at the end of this great lunch to rapturous applause and was on the stage in Beijing when I was there about 3 weeks ago. So if you add in 140,000 Chinese students in the UK today, increasing cooperation between the health services at all sorts of different levels, I discovered my own hospital in Gloucester now has an exchange program with a medical institute in Hangzhou, entirely by accident the other day. You can see that this relationship over the 35 years is just many, many times what it was. And no surprise, therefore, that the size of the taxpayer-funded army representing all of us in this room in China is now over 600. I think, Martin, when I was part of that embassy in Beijing, I think it was about 60, so that's sort of 10 times growth. And, of course, trade has doubled in the last few years alone. If you just look in every constituency in the land, the links are extraordinary. From my small city of 100,000 people alone, we export a range of stuff that includes dental drills, marine diesel engines, Gantrails, health and safety training courses, giant valves for the oil and gas sector, tailor-made cylinders, and a bundle of stuff in the auto and above all in the aerospace supply chain, including the landing gear on every Airbus that flies in China today. And that is the story everywhere. Indeed, we even export Chinese tea, reflavored, back to China. So what about Parliament? How does Parliament fit into this evolving trust and relationship? President Xi Jinping was incredibly polite yesterday in Parliament. He referred to the All-Party Parliamentary China Group several times. I think probably slightly exaggerating the depth of the content of the exchanges that we have with the National People's Congress. We're in the early stages, really, of a relationship that's still finding its feet, in my view. But what we do agree on is that although we do have these very different values, very different systems, very different constitutions, we do actually share a huge number of very similar problems, which include both being ageing societies, both tackling issues of care for the elderly, both looking at how we help people with mental health issues, particularly back into employment, and a whole number of areas like that which are not really contentious. It's about sharing best practice and ideas, and I think that's what parliamentarians can do. So, there are, in the terms of the trust, we do come from very different places. The Vice Chairman of the National People's Congress opening statement in the meeting I had with him 3 weeks ago was 37 minutes, of which 31 minutes was taken up with Tibet. That probably isn't quite the way we'll do it when they come to the UK. But let me finish with a story, if I may, Michael, very briefly. In the mid-1990s, when I was living in Shanghai, my wife was doing some good work with an orphanage on Zhongming Island, just in the Yangtze River outside Shanghai. And the conditions in that orphanage were incredibly difficult. Large numbers of babies, many of whom died there without much care. A Channel 4 journalist got hold of this story, went there, filmed it undercover, and produced a very controversial film in China at that time. The net result was simply the orphanage was closed to all foreigners. But what my wife and I did was something different, which was to launch a charity in Hong Kong, which then became a British charity and then a joint venture charity with China to promote the cause of foster care. The Shanghai government eventually bought the idea, the Chinese government bought the idea, and since 1997, when we started, care for children has fostered somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 orphans. And the point I really want to make is that there are always two options in life. You can stand outside and criticise and throw stones and not really do anything at all. or you can get stuck in, engage, be persistent, and try and achieve something worthwhile. And that's why Britain and China must stick together.
Thank you very much. Being neither British nor Chinese, I consider myself the neutral party in this conflict. So should Britain and China stick together, my answer will be yes. Or rather, it will be yes. Why not? We tried everything else already. But I wanted to start with an experience I had last year in a place far away from Britain and China, namely Yellowstone Park in the United States. And I was sitting there on a bench waiting for the geyser called Old Faithful to erupt. And all of a sudden, I found myself surrounded by a large group of Chinese tourists who had just emerged from a coach. And I looked around and I looked at them and I saw a group of happy, affluent people who were curious about the world, who were enjoying themselves. And after they'd watched the geyser eruption, went back on the coach and went somewhere else. And it struck me that none of these people looked like the kind of people that are so often portrayed in our media when they talk about China. They didn't look like they were citizens of a country that, where they are oppressed or where they have no human rights or no democracy. It simply didn't fit the picture. So one of the things I wanted to talk about today and I've been asked to address is the actual cultural changes that have been taking place in China. And we've heard some of them already in the previous presentations. In the urban centers of China, global culture is being fully participated in, especially by younger Chinese people. They drink Starbucks, they know about our celebrities, they like Wayne Rooney, they go on tourist trips to places like Yellowstone Park, they read self-help books, they go to bars and clubs, they follow global trends. There are some gaps as well. Certain Hollywood movies are not being shown, they can't read 50 Shades of Grey, they can't access Google, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And that lack of access to certain internet applications has, in recent years, often become a defining characteristic in the way in which we portray China. So I've lost count of the many times I've seen China described in the media as the country that blocks Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Now, as an academic who's often trying to persuade his students to spend less time on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, I ask myself, does Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter really sum up Western democratic culture, the thing that China needs? And I don't think it does. And similarly, I don't think we can define China or the Chinese system by the absence of those things. So we need a more nuanced approach. A lot of people talk about the internet in China. There are 650 million internet users in China, which is a penetration rate of roughly 50%. And 85% of internet users in China do so on their mobile devices. Now, for a very long time, people thought that the internet would bring democracy to China. In fact, about 90% of the scholarship done on the internet in China, in this country, and also in the US, focuses on that particular question. Does the internet bring democracy to China? Well, it hasn't. So we got it wrong. So now what? Well, then you might say the reason why this is not happening is because of censorship. The great firewall, as it is often described, that thing around China that prevents people from gaining access to wonderful things they need in order to change their system. It's, whatever you think of that, it's worth bearing in mind that the great firewall is a metaphor that comes from the era of the Cold War. I remember being in the 1980s in China, people trying to receive the Voice of America or the BBC World Service on their sort of portable radios. And in those days, there were walls, and it was very difficult to send a signal from one side of the wall to the other side of the wall. But the internet doesn't work like that. The internet doesn't go from point A to point B. The internet goes through lots of different channels and lots of different points, from one place to another and back again. It's a great network and a great mess. Also, the internet enables Chinese people to do lots of interesting things inside China, for which they don't have to go outside. So the idea that there might be one wall somehow keeping Chinese people from accessing useful information is simply incorrect. The internet is, in fact, the freest medium in China at the moment, and it's provided many new means of forms of communication, and it's brought about many cultural changes. A lot of people talk about censorship in China. The way in which censorship was carried out prior to the economic reforms, prior to 1978, was very simple, through state monopoly on paper. It's very difficult to publish something controversial if you don't have the paper to print it on. In the 80s and in the 90s, the control mainly happened through the state issuing of ISBN numbers. In China, it's illegal to publish a book without an ISBN number. And the state has to issue those numbers. Now, in the age of the internet, it's still illegal to publish a book without an ISBN number, yet on the internet in China, 500 novels are being published per day. 500 novels per day of an average of 200 to 300 chapters. And none of them have ISBN numbers. Now, this phenomenon, this new sector in Chinese publishing and Chinese cultural life, it may not push the boundaries of what is allowed in China in terms of political activity, but it does push the boundaries in many ways in terms of reflecting social changes, new lifestyles, and new ways of thinking. And this is not insignificant. The best example you can think of here is, and those of around the table who were in China in the 80s will remember that in those days, people were addressing each other very regularly as comrade, or the Chinese word 同志. Nowadays, if you look up the word 同志 or comrade on the internet, you will find that it has become the term to refer to the LGBT community. So I did a search of this term on the Chinese internet this morning. And what you find is, you know, you get hundreds of pages to do with LGBT LGBT websites, and then every now and then there's a Communist Party website saying comrade so-and-so has passed away and he was a great hero. And they obviously mean different things. And, you know, this is the kind of change that's going on in China. In academia, we refer to it as post-socialism. It's a kind of sort of mess where socialism still has a function, but we're not always clear what it is. And the Chinese Communist Party does worry about that. Only a few years ago, they held a party plenum where their entire discussion was to do with how to control culture. The Communist Party and the Chinese state feels that they should be having a say in how culture develops. They want to keep it healthy, they want to keep it socialist, they see it as part of their soft power policy. Economically, China doesn't necessarily provide a massive alternative to what's happening here, but they want their alternative to be a cultural alternative. They want to build a different system compared to the system we have here. So Xi Jinping, for instance, famously last year met with writers and artists and suggested to them that perhaps they should visit the countryside and learn from the peasants and reflect that in their writing. This created a predictable uproar in the media here. Xi Jinping is going back to the Mao Zedong era, the Cultural Revolution is about to emerge. The reaction in China was quite different. People just shrugged their shoulders. What's this? I mean, why is he using this language again? We simply, you know, this is in the past, we don't do this anymore. The socialist discourse is seen as extremely outdated. Same in higher education. Universities were told last year to make sure that there was no Western ideological influence in their textbooks. Again, this was picked up on here as being this sort of threat to academic freedom in China. For most academics in China, it was just a nuisance. They had to go through all their textbooks, write reports, and say, no, no Western ideological influence. No, no, no. Every book, they just had to go through this paper exercise. And everybody thought it was absolutely silly. And it is silly, and we do the exact same thing. Read, if you will, the many articles that have been written about the presence of Confucius Institutes in this country and other countries, especially in the US, the textbooks that they use, and whether or not those textbooks might perhaps have ideological influences and propaganda that we might not like. I've had a student complaining that one of the teachers from China was telling him that Tibet was a part of China. And if I could please prevent that teacher from saying that, then I said, no. If you want to study China, then you have to understand where these opinions come from. You have to make up your own mind. I'm not going to censor my teachers. And I think the UK is very special in terms of how it deals with these things. And I say this as someone who's not originally from this country. The UK has 27 Confucius Institutes and 95 Confucius classrooms, which is many more than any other European country. Chinese is taught at over 90% of UK universities. There's an enormous amount of examples of the sort of the special relationship that has nothing to do with the governments, that has to do with people-to-people relationships. The crowds yesterday at the palace and then on the mall, the mall, sorry, were a good example of how much enthusiasm is being generated by this visit and by this relationship. There are many Chinese people there who I think was not in any way forced to be there. They haven't been brainwashed. They're just very proud of the fact that this is happening, and they were probably taking pictures and sending them back over the internet via WeChat and Weibo to their friends back in China. So I think at a people-to-people level, there's much that ties China and the UK together, and I really don't see it so much in other European countries. I'm not a politician. I can't judge if Osborne is right or not when he says we must stick together, but I do believe, and I have for some time, that the conventional approach towards China, which emphasizes the difference of their system and the superiority of our own, is getting stale and sounds hollow to most people you meet in China. They shrug their shoulders when Xi Jinping mentions socialism. They also shrug their shoulders when we mention human rights. They are not interested in that old conflict and these old oppositions. So it's time to try something new, and that, I think, is what the UK is doing. Fewer public gestures, more people-to-people engagement, and the future will tell whether or not it was a good idea. Thank you.